KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Saul Gonzalez sitting in for Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
You listen, if you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks show business.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, filmmakers Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris on their new movie, Ruby Sparks, and the pressure to follow their hit film, Little Miss Sunshine. Plus, the linguist who created an original language for the HBO fantasy series Game of Thrones. But first, it's the Hollywood News Banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
I'm John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Kim Masters is away on assignment today, so I am joined by Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. Hello, Mike.
Hi, John.
In the wake of the horrible shootings in Aurora, Colorado, Warner Brothers has decided to postpone the release of Gangster Squad. This is a 1940s period crime story about Mickey Cohen and his attempted takeover of Los Angeles. It's a high-profile film with Sean Penn and Ryan Gosling, which featured as one of its centerpiece action scenes a shootout in a movie theater in which any number of innocent moviegoers were gunned down. The studio has pulled the release from September to January, and while they're not admitting that they're going to reshoot the scene, I think it's inevitable that this will be a different version of the film once it comes out in theaters.
Well, they sort of have to, right? We've seen the clips now, and it's chilling. Even though it is a period piece, it's chilling to see a bunch of guys shooting up a theater in light of what happened. And the fact that that trailer was actually showing at certain theaters playing Dark Knight Rises until Warner Brothers asked theaters to pull it is also a little frightening to think about now.
I think it'll be interesting if this is just, you know, the one film that Hollywood takes a look at, or if there's a general reconsideration of how it's depicting violence post-Colorado. I suspect the answer is they will for about another 24 hours, and then it will be back to business as usual.
Right, right. There still doesn't seem to be a ton of correlation between Hollywood violence and the tragic actions in Colorado. So far, that hasn't become a topic, but this is an election season, so you never know when Hollywood will become the punching bag.
The other big news in town is the Television Critics Association meetings, where you have been attending. And I guess the big news right now out of the TCA meetings is American Idol and its new judge.
Right. It does seem like clockwork now. Just about every year or two, there is a judge sort of a changing of the guard with American Idol. Still the most watched television show on the air right now, but it's obviously taken a big hit this year. The show was down 23%. And now Jennifer Lopez and Steven Tyler have both announced that they're leaving. But Mariah Carey has come in to save the day at a hefty price tag as well, $17 million for a year of Mariah Carey on American Idol. And I think that's probably good news for the show. Viewers this year said, you know what, we want change. We didn't get change. And as a result, they stopped watching.
That's not the only big kind of negotiation or cast news coming out of TCA. The big legal argument right now is over the future of Modern Family. The studio behind it, Fox, recently sold the show at $1.5 million an episode to USA. It is ABC's second highest rated show behind Dancing with the Stars. And now the cast thinks they deserve a little bit more of those riches.
Well, and they do. First off, it is a massive hit. And so far, the cast, for the most part, is making only about $65,000 an episode. Ed O'Neill, who was the biggest star coming into the show, is making a little bit more, about $100,000 an episode. But I think what surprises most people is how ugly this negotiation has gotten. These negotiations happen all the time. It happened for shows like The Big Bang Theory, where things didn't get ugly. No one didn't show up to a table read. There was no lawsuit. But in this case, you had the cast holding out. They didn't show up to their first table read. They filed lawsuit against the studio. And I think the message was delivered. They pulled back the second table read that was scheduled. The cast actually did show up as a sign of good faith. I think everyone thinks a deal's going to be done. Everyone's going to be happy. The show will be back. But it got ugly there for a second.
What they're basically claiming is that their contracts are unfair, that they have been bound to a contract that exceeds the 7-year statutory limit in the state of California, and that these contracts punish them by preventing them from doing other work, which is really a preposterous argument. I can't go off and write for the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. I'm an employee of the LA Times. These people work for a TV show. And if you really look at their credits, they are able to do any number of movies. I think what's interesting is that they had to resort to litigation. And if they are successful in what they hope they will get, they'll probably be making each about $4 to $5 million in a couple seasons if this show continues on its upward trajectory. So I don't think we have to take a collection for them yet.
They'll be doing okay. And I think that lawsuit will quickly go away.
The spirited negotiations over Modern Family aren't the only big talks that are in town right now. Kim is down in New Zealand with Peter Jackson, who has decided that maybe there is a third Hobbit film after all. The original plan was to shoot two films back to back. The first Hobbit film is coming out in December of this year. The next one, December of the following year. And I think Peter Jackson apparently took a look at the first film, thought it was really good, and thought maybe there was a way to make a third film. The unfortunate thing is the movies have wrapped, and now Warner Brothers, the studio behind the film, has to reassemble the cast, which is in an unusually strong negotiating position now. So the cast, which includes Ian McKellen, now has to figure out whether and how much it will cost them to do a third film.
Now, John, trilogies seem to be the norm these days, given Dark Knight, given Lord of the Rings. Why didn't they plan for this anyway?
Well, I mean, people who are familiar with The Hobbit would say it's a pretty episodic book that doesn't go in a lot of different directions. But in adapting the book for the screen, Peter Jackson and his screenwriters looked to the appendices of The Lord of the Rings, which was obviously a very successful trilogy. So it felt to them as if they had enough story material, and maybe two movies made the most sense at the time. But I guess if you look at what you have, you know that it plays well, you think there's enough story material to add to a third film, you know, in for a dime, in for another couple hundred million dollars. It still is unresolved whether or not they'll be able to pull it off, but certainly Warner's is deep in negotiations to see if they can figure this out.
So in other words, don't go buying those movie tickets just yet.
Exactly. Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, John.
That was John Horn of the Los Angeles Times and Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. And I'm Saul Gonzalez, sitting in for Kim Masters. Coming up later in the show, how a Berkeley-trained linguist with no ties to Hollywood got the gig creating a new language for HBO's Game of Thrones. But first, Ruby Sparks. In the summer of movie blockbusters, there are those occasional smaller character-driven films for people looking for something different. One such movie is Ruby Sparks, which came out this past week. It's about a young novelist struggling with both writer's block and romantic stagnation. The writer, as writers do, creates a fictional dream girl, but this one springs to life.
This is insane! You manifested a woman with your mind!
You can't tell anybody, not Mom, not Susie,
so no. So we're just gonna pretend she's your girlfriend?
She is my girlfriend. Stranger things have happened?
I don't think so. I think this is pretty much the strangest thing that's ever happened, ever.
Please don't ruin this for me. Promise me, no one.
Ruby Sparks is directed by Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris. It's the follow-up to their first film, the 2006 indie sensation Little Miss Sunshine. It took them 4 years to make that movie and 6 years to make Ruby Sparks. Dayton and Faris recently came to KCRW to talk with Kim.
So it took a long time for you guys to make Little Miss Sunshine. And I don't know, I mean, you were doing music videos. That is what you were doing. And maybe commercials
and
at commercials. That
point. Commercials, yeah. And documentaries.
And was it that this was the movie you were going to make and there were other opportunities that you didn't want to do? Or, you know, was this just a struggle to get a movie made without a lot of people saying, come and make a movie?
When we made these two Smashing Pumpkins videos in 96, we started getting offers. And, you know, they were interesting and we went down the road on a few of them. But we soon realized how tricky it is to get all the elements together, particularly the script. And so it took a while, and then we read Little Miss Sunshine and knew this was, you know, what we had to do. But even that took 4 years to go into production.
So, Valerie, what's happened? What's going on for 4 years?
6 years. You mean since Little Miss Sunshine?
No, I'm going to guess.
During, yeah,
I'm
yeah.
The
during
6 years.
The 4 years.
Maybe you're like those locusts who only come out
yes,
every so
yeah.
often.
I think we are. I'm starting to feel the clock. Well, you know, with Little Miss Sunshine, I think it was a ensemble piece for one, which makes it harder to cast because there's not like a leading role in it. So we were with a studio that was trying to get big stars to cast in that movie, and they...
For no money.
For no money. Finally, after the 4 years of trying to get it made at a studio, the producers just said, we're going to pay for it. We'll just make it ourselves.
But I have to say, we couldn't agree on cast with the studio, so the studio dropped us.
Are we going to mention the name of the studio?
Yeah, we can say everyone knows. It's Focus.
Thank you.
Yeah, so we worked with Focus for 4 years trying to come up with a cast.
That's, I should say, Universal's art picture form. Yeah.
And they even did a rewrite of the script against our will. And finally, it was clear that we weren't trying to make the same movie, and so they dropped the film. And then our producers, it's a little bit like The Wizard of Oz, where they come to Dorothy and said, you had the power all along. You could make this. We have the money. Just click your ruby slippers and you'll go home.
We'll make our movie.
And so they made our movie by financing it themselves, and then we sold it at Sundance.
To Fox Searchlight, and that was a fun way to sort of bring your first movie to the to the public. It was really... I don't think we'll ever have that experience again, having kind of the first public viewing of the movie also be the place where it gets sold. And, you know, it really was kind of an exciting...
That's one of those lightning striking kind of
situations. Yeah, it was very once in a lifetime.
We were ruined forever.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, had you put yourselves out on a limb with it, financially, personally?
Well, no. I know you have
a family.
Yes. No, we have three kids, yes. Private school. And, you know, we had to actually save up in order to, you know, spend the 2 years it takes to really go through the filmmaking process.
You can't do any other work.
You can't run off and do a music video.
No, yeah, or a commercial. And so, yeah, it was a bit of a hit financially for us.
I mean, I don't want to pry into your financial affairs, no. But were you profit participants, I hope.
Yes.
But it's not as exciting as one would think.
You get residuals, and we got some bonuses, box office bonuses.
But it wasn't like a windfall. But,
it wasn't like, you know, Jack Nicholson gross participation.
I think the stars in the movie probably made more than we did. Mm-hmm. They had box office, which was great. I was so happy about that. So,
I mean, the obvious benefit was that there was a lot of interest in us as directors, and we got a lot of offers, and we were sent a lot of scripts, and we started working immediately. We were working with Dave Eggers and Vendela Vida for a while, and then Tom Parada and Dimitri Martin.
We spent, you know, probably an average of a year and a half to 2 years on a number of projects, not all at the same time. We usually don't do more than really one at a time, but, you know, for whatever reason, those projects just didn't fall into place like this one did.
I think that Tom Parada was the abstinence teacher, mm-hmm. Dimitri Martin's comedy Will, mm-hmm. the comedy Used Guys. Oh, that one was the one that was a big budget movie.
That was a big budget movie, and Jay Roach had worked on it for years, and then it was dormant, and then we came back, and we did a draft with Michael Arndt, and then we worked with Guion and Handelman. I mean, it was a long road.
I loved that project. And, you know, every project you love and you kind of get your heart set on it. And for whatever reason, you know, if for us, I think we're pretty particular, and we want to know going into it that we can make a good film and that the conditions are going to be, you know, right for us. Like that we see the same movie as the studio sees. And
the stars
and
see.
And the producers. And you just can't, you know, it is about perseverance and patience. And also, I think, you know, saying no, if you don't feel like it's going to be a good thing. It's 2 years of our lives. We have a family. It takes too much of a toll on us if we don't love what we're doing.
Do you run off in between and say, let's do a commercial, honey?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 And it's
he's
it's,
usually pressuring.
It's
us
kind
to
of
do.
A miracle that, you know,
you're the one
we
Jonathan.
Can turn on that spigot, and we're very lucky, and it really does allow us to take our time developing films. And we're working on a TV pilot right now for HBO. So it's very nice to have one foot in features and one foot in commercials.
And maybe in TV.
So literally it's okay in this world, I mean, to just kind of be like, we're available, we're not available, we're available, we're not available?
Not with our executive producers at our commercial company. They get so angry with us because we're always saying, well, we can't work for the next 3 months because this movie's going to happen. And then the movie falls apart and they're like, we tell everyone you're not available and then you are available. Luckily, that business is a little more forgiving. You know, you can kind of drop in and out of it.
Have we seen commercials? I mean, they don't roll credits at the end of commercials.
No.
Which
yeah.
ones? Which? What's your most famous commercial of the post-Miss Sunshine era?
Oh, post-Miss Sunshine. Pre-Little Miss Sunshine, we did a Volkswagen commercial that was titled Pink Moon. It had a Nick Drake song, and it was sort of famous for bringing Nick Drake back. You know, he sold more records than he ever did while he was alive.
Pink Moon is on its way.
Post Little Miss Sunshine,
you know, Gap, Apple.
God, we did these NBA commercials for the National Basketball Association with the faces were split in half. And what was kind of fun about that, it was a big campaign before the playoffs. And then it was also the election year. And during the primaries, Time Magazine did a cover with Hillary on one side and Obama on the other.
And the slogan for our campaign was, there can only be one. And so,
so you know that you've entered the popular culture. So it's fun doing commercials just in that we also get to work with really great crews and, you know, we get to practice our craft.
If you're just joining us, I'm Saul Gonzalez, sitting in for Kim Masters. We're listening to an interview Kim did with filmmakers Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris, the married couple who co-directed Little Miss Sunshine. Their new movie is Ruby Sparks, which stars Paul Dano, the big brother from Little Miss Sunshine, and Zoe Kazan, who wrote the script for the film.
So at some point, Ruby Sparks comes along. And you spark to it. I'm sure I'm the first person to ever say that, right? I just created that clever joke. But go. Well, how did that work?
Well, we had known, you know, we'd stayed in touch with Paul Dano after Little Miss Sunshine, and we had met Zoe, and I guess she'd been working on this, and they'd been thinking about us for it, but they didn't tell us anything about that until she had finished her first draft. And, you know, we felt a lot of pressure reading it because we really loved them as actors, and we loved the idea of making this small movie, and thankfully, we really loved the script. We loved the idea of it. And we did end up doing about 9 months of work on the script. And then Fox Searchlight read the script and, you know, immediately said, we want to make this. We want to make it this summer. So it happened very fast. For us, it was faster, you know, process than any other film we'd worked on.
They, of course, distributed Little Miss Sunshine, so there was a relationship there.
Yeah.
You didn't have to shop it around a lot.
No, they
kind of chased after it, which was really nice and gave us final cut.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what sort of thing were you not interested in making?
You know, really big budget, anything, a franchise or sequel or that doesn't have any substance. You know, just I think most of the time we read scripts and we just, I don't know what this is about. I don't really care about any of these people in it.
Mm-hmm. Was there a thing in your heads about how do we follow Little Miss Sunshine?
Oh,
is that
course.
Part of the reason?
Absolutely. Yeah. It was very intoxicating going to theaters and sitting in there and watching people laugh like that and be moved. But, you know, it's a different movie now with Ruby Sparks, but we're getting some of the same passionate response. You know, it was interesting when we went to do the publicity campaign for this film and do the poster, their research said that the most important promotional element was from the directors of Little Miss Sunshine, which was interesting for us to hear. And
it's flattering. I don't know how much people pay attention to that or go in thinking it's going to be another Little Miss Sunshine.
I think they kind of do. It's a bad thing in a way, right?
I was concerned about that. Like, you know, it's a very different movie. It has plenty of humor in it, but you know, you always worry a little bit about expectation, but at the same time, hopefully once they start watching the movie, they forget about it.
I have to say, though, it's so nice just to have something else out there so that our filmmaking is not
defined by one film.
Yeah.
Coming up after a short break, how Faris and Dayton reconcile the personal and professional in Hollywood. Plus, a linguist gets into show business by way of HBO's Game of Thrones. To make a comment about today's show, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
You're listening to The Business, and I'm Saul Gonzalez, in for Kim Masters, who's on assignment in New Zealand covering the making of The Hobbit for The Hollywood Reporter. We're listening to an interview Kim did with filmmakers Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris. They have a new movie out, the romantic comedy Ruby Sparks, which follows their 2006 hit, Little Miss Sunshine. Dayton and Faris are a married couple who co-direct their films.
So how do you actually split responsibilities as co-directors? They're looking at each other. I'm just going to give you the visual here. There's an exchange of glances.
You know, we're very much of a similar sensibility, and we do a lot of prep on a movie so that we've done all the arguing and all the kind of working stuff out behind the scenes so that when we come to set, anybody can ask either one of us a question and for the most part get the same answer.
When we start doing a scene, if one of us has a note for an actor, we will continue to give that actor notes for the rest of the scene. So there's never a danger of us saying
me
one thing.
Me being in one ear and Jonathan being in the other.
Right. Do you find that it infiltrates into your life at home? Like you're walking around making dinner and saying, I really think he should not go to the drugstore at that moment.
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But I like that. I think we're both the kind of people that don't mind shifting gears and, you know, mixing family life, love life. You know, I like sharing all that, and I think because we're so engaged with each other at work, it just makes us better at what we do as parents, too, because we're problem-solving all day long at work, and so when we, you know, there's a lot of problem-solving to do as parents, so I think we're better at dealing with those issues as well.
I'm curious, I mean, do you find that you have to go somehow structure away from each other time to just not be together all the time?
We find that time, but, you know,
not very often.
Not very often. But when you get home, the kids immediately kick in and, you know, there's plenty of distraction.
And even work, even though we're side by side working together, we're so focused on the work and not really on each other that I don't have the sense like I've been with him all day long.
I mean, filmmaking is always a collaborative experience, and sometimes it's more official than others. You know, there's this new Hitchcock movie they're making about the time that he decided to do Psycho, and he did it on his own. And behind the scenes, his wife was helping him out at every turn.
He had a nervous breakdown, and she really rescued him and that film, it sounds like.
So you have one of the most celebrated auteurs actually
completely dependent on his spouse.
Well, I think there are lots of hidden partnerships in the world. Valerie Faris and Jonathan Dayton are the co-directors of the new film Ruby Sparks, now playing in theaters. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
As it tries to entertain increasingly savvy audiences, Hollywood now makes a practice of hiring experts to bring authenticity to its films and TV shows. That goes from set design to costuming to the language used. In medical dramas, physicians are consulted to make sure the hospital jargon is spot on. But how do you make fantasy or science fiction productions sound authentic? One way, as I recently learned, is to hire a linguist. You're listening to a pretty macho language spoken by fierce warriors in a far-off land, but created by a gentle, unassuming guy who invented it in his Orange County studio apartment.
My name is David Peterson, and I'm the creator of the Dothraki language for HBO's Game of Thrones.
Peterson, a Berkeley-trained linguist, is a constructed language expert, or conlanger to those in the know. Conlangers are people who don't just study existing languages. They make up new ones from scratch. Now, Peterson was creating his languages in relative obscurity when in 2009 he found out about a linguistic casting call from Hollywood.
There's a job to create a language for a television show. Anybody's interested, apply.
The language was Dothraki, and the show was the HBO fantasy series Game of Thrones, adapted from the popular series of books. To snag the job, Peterson went to work creating a 300-page book of vocabulary, grammar, and syntax for Dothraki. After two rounds of competition against other linguists, he got the gig from show producers David Benioff and Dan Weisskopf.
What were the producers looking to express through this language that you created?
The Dothraki are supposed to be seen as, a kind of a natural horse-riding, semi-barbarous people. They hunt and they raid and they kind of live life that way. And I think that that Dave and Dan, at least, were looking for a language that kind of embodied that aesthetic.
Andava já com manvri que no chora. Mama queve a fin more a ti mai.
What's he saying?
He says yes.
Peterson explains people have been making up languages for centuries, often for philosophical or religious reasons. Hollywood got into the Created Language Act as a way to bring greater authenticity to films and TV shows. The most famous example is the invention of Klingon for the Star Trek movies.
Star Trek itself had such a huge following that the very notion that there could be a language in the films really kind of took off and got people excited.
Doshibosh. Necht. Yazju.
In the years since, languages have been created for films like Lord of the Rings and Avatar, but because it's for an entire series that could run for many seasons, the most complex language created so far for Hollywood is Peterson's Dothraki.
They're supposed to be a real people, and so they needed something to speak that actually sounded real. And not only that, that sounded unique. So it didn't sound like, you know, just modified Arabic or modified Mongolian or anything like that.
Would the producers or the writers know the difference between, you know, a modified language and one that was completely fresh and new?
Theoretically, I suppose not. But of course, that's really not the point, right? Because at this stage of the game, it's the fans that matter.
And it's those Game of Thrones fans that analyze every production detail on the show, including Peterson's fantasy language. If there's an inconsistency or problem, they'll hear it. It's also crucial that nothing gets lost in translation for the show's writers and cast.
So I get the scripts. They have everything written in English, and then I translate everything. I write it down and I put it in, you know, big PDFs, and then I record everything on MP3, all the lines, and then I send them off. What I try to do with the recordings is basically put all the inflection in the proper place so that they know what parts of the words need to be emphasized and what parts of the sentence need to be emphasized.
Can you just show me something over there? Is there something that you had in terms of sound files or something that we can listen to?
Okay. Oh, well, this is one that uses one of the famous Dothraki phrases here.
And you're really like acting there. I mean, you get into these characters.
Oh, yeah. It's a lot of fun.
But Peterson acknowledges not all people in the language creation community are happy with the Hollywood exposure.
I mean, for example, there's a rather vocal minority who believes that we shouldn't have created languages in any movies or films, or that they don't want the general public to know about it, mm-hmm. because they see it as kind of a private activity, something that they do, something that's special to them, and the more people who know about it, the less special it is.
However, Peterson has no plans to stop. He already has his next gig, creating two new languages for a coming Steven Spielberg project for the Sci-Fi Network. And he's also getting other linguists into show business.
Keep your eyes peeled. There is, we were able to get a job for another community member for a major blockbuster motion picture that's coming. I can't say anything about it, but just stay tuned.
And to see a video of linguist David Peterson speaking Dothraki, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness. And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to us anytime on demand with the KCRW smartphone apps. And you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. The show is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Saul Gonzalez, sitting in for Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.